Hello, welcome to Robin and Josie's Utter Shambles, Josie and Robin's Utter Shambles.
Thank
we
you.
Are egalitarian in that way. And today's a very special show where two old men are going to talk about what it was like in the 80s while a younger woman looks on with disgust.
So like any TV show, really.
Any TV show or any of our podcasts, predominantly. We're joined by Stuart Lee.
Hello.
Stuart, the reason that we're meant to be doing specific subjects in each one of these podcasts, it hasn't really worked, has it?
It didn't happen. What's the subject today?
Well, it's alternative comedy, because it's something that we've talked about a lot in the past, and Josie, we've talked about it, which is there is now considered to be, by some, a kind of the mainstream and the alternative. Again,
yeah.
As there was, but it's slightly different to the 1970s, 1979 thing, because like people still say these alternative comedians like Michael McIntyre,
yeah.
Which seems to be entirely, you go, it's like saying, you know, alternative bands like Radiohead and REM. Once you've got over 20,000 in a stadium, the alternative nature is kind of gone. So I wanted to start off just by saying, what was the first live comedy that you saw?
The first live comedy I saw, right, ever, was the Two Ronnies. At a theatre in Coventry when I was about eight, which was really, really brilliant. And to this day has been one of the... There was, the sort of five times in my life when I've fallen to the floor in pain laughing, that was one of them. And that was really good. But the first sort of grown-up...
I had no idea they did live shows.
Yeah, they did a tour. And interestingly, about half of it was an episode of Porridge, which Ronnie Barker did with some of the other guys in Porridge on a prison set. It was an incredibly long Ronnie Corbett monologue. But the thing that made me fall on the floor laughing was one of the Ronnie Barker things where he gets his words mixed up. And he was talking about, it was like Cockney rhyming slang, and he was talking about a little brown Richard III. But from the amount that the other people in the room were laughing, I realised that it couldn't mean birds, that it must have meant something to do with excrement. Now, it was obviously turd, but I didn't understand that at the time. But I've realised that something adult was going on that I didn't get. And once I sort of guessed it, I remember just being on the floor in the aisles at the Coventry Belgrade, crying with laughter at that. And there's, very few other times that's happened. Twice I've been with Kevin McAleer, once I think with Paul Foot. But, you know, that first one, the first one of losing absolute physical control was watching the Two Ronnies. But the first time I saw comedy sort of as an adult, would have been the first wave of sort of alternative people. In fact, the first thing I ever saw was Peter Richardson from the comic strip opening for Dex's Midnight Runners.
Did he do on his own?
Yeah, he was on his own. Yeah, doing a character of a Mexican bandit, which subsequently ended up being the backbone of the comic strip episode Fistful of Traveller's Checks.
Yeah, it's in that and in War as well.
It went down pretty badly. They were just on the verge of becoming sort of pop stars again off the back of Come On Eileen. And most of the audience weren't, a crowd that would have gone for it. But in those days, there was a kind of thing where stand-ups would be on with the post-punk, with the bands in the sort of immediate post-punk era. And subsequently, I met Peter Richards, who was a writer for Peter Richardson. And he said they only ever did that character once live, and it was supporting Dex Midnight Runners in Birmingham. It went so badly, he never did it again. But I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I really, really loved it. Then the next thing I saw was Phil Jupitus opening for Billy Bragg about 12 months later when he was called Porky the Poet. And Billy Bragg back then used to tour these like sort of review shows where it was it would be him, the Frank Chickens, like Hank Wangford's country and western band, the Sid Presley Experience, who were like an amazing kind of sort of Stooges kind of hard rock sort of band that became the Godfathers. And Phil Jupitus used to be on a lot as well. And I saw Phil a couple of times with Billy Bragg being Porky the Poet, which, again, he used to do... I think he started doing that act again.
He did
Edinburgh this year.
And it's sort of like it was... Again, it seemed amazing at the time. It was sort of the kind of first ideas you would have as a teenager. I mean, he was only about 17, 18, and he was a fanzine editor. He edited a fanzine called Jamming, and he would have been very young. And he used to do things about, what if there was a riot in Trumpton, and he'd do a poem about Trumpton, but it was all like the Brixton riots, that kind of
thing. Hang on, that's Half Man, Half Biscuit.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that one, there was another one.
I was going to say, otherwise everyone's going to go, that Jupe is a rip-off, wasn't he?
It was those sorts of things, And then the next thing, I've talked about this so many times that I probably will just say it exactly as I ever have done. The pivotal thing for me was seeing, I probably saw Rowan Atkinson around that time on tour. And they did a theatre tour with Angus Deaton as the sort of support guy.
What sort of theatres? Are you talking like 400 seaters or 1,000?
What with Rowan Atkinson, 400 or 500 seater, probably been the Alex in Birmingham. You know, I mean, not there wasn't the thing then. Nobody was doing stadiums, and comics didn't. It didn't really. They do 30 dates. You know, didn't really think there was a market out there. So when it was exceptional to see, I remember not going to see the Rick Mayall and Alexi Sale tour. I can't remember why I didn't go. I remember not going to Dave Allen as well. I remember my friend James trying to get me to go to both of them and not going, and I really regret that. But the thing I saw that was why I'm here today was, which we talked about before, well, all of us are different, it was when I was 15, 16, seeing Ted Chippington open for The Fall, which was sort of, it was amazing to see someone doing really weird stand-up to an audience that didn't particularly want to see it, not caring about whether it went down badly or well, but that it being hysterical for pockets of the room, you know, and I think that basically that was created a very bad precedent in my mind that I've tried to maintain ever since. But in those days, stand-ups did used to go on with bands, and I've been asked to do it. I'm sure we all have. I've been asked a number of times, would you open for people? I opened for the Nightingales about 10 years ago because Ted Chippington used to, and that was okay. But I had to do my 1988 open spot set because you have to have something punchy, and I'm opening for the X, who were. For the 35th anniversary of the X, the Dutch anarchist free jazz hardcore punk world music band at Cafe Otto on the 30th of November. Well, I don't quite know what I'm going to do there.
But that's a different thing, isn't it? Because the moment it becomes really art house, if you've got a pop band, like as everyone knows, you know, Matt Lucas supported Blur, and of course that was, they were a very successful indie pop band and a guy that at that point no one had ever really heard of. And I think
Vegas went down very badly supporting Embrace as well, I remember.
But also, you've got to think about it from a staging point of view, because like then you've got people who like need to sound check or test stuff, and it's sort of a weird atmosphere to then go out and you'll have a bloody radio mic just nowhere near as good.
I hate being an old man, which and thinking about it, but I do think it was slightly different 30 years ago. Because
I think it's exactly the same.
Well, because there wasn't the YouTube. And there was only three channels of telly.
Can I just say, if you call it the YouTube, you seem more like an old man.
I know.
You've been on the YouTube.
I know. And then when someone came out, you'd never have seen anything like it. Yeah. So you'd shut up and listened, or you at least give it the benefit of the doubt, because it was
really
amazing, because there was no other way of finding out about these things. So, you know, so spoke in an immediate post-punk era, stand-ups or performance poets or performance artists on a bill, people gave them the time of day because I think they weren't saturated with options, so you kind of think, "All right, let's see how that goes down." Not always.
Whereas now you can think all comics are immediately shit as you go onto YouTube and find something that was filmed on someone's phone and then is cut at the point of the punchline and all of those. Yeah, yeah. But you're right. I mean, I think that is an interesting, because I wonder again as old men. Sorry, Josie, but the kind of excitement of word of mouth. When I first went to the Comedy Store, when it was the second incarnation, it was still Broken Chairs down in the subterranean. And I went there, and there was Julian Clary's Joan Collins fan club, with, at that point, very long blonde hair, rubber vest, Fanny the Wonder Dog. There was Andrew Bailey there in his Freddie Benson incarnation, this guy in an enormous glitter jacket with a skull face, climbing over beams and challenging to cut people's hair while then playing a mini harmonica attached to an action man. And there was a sense of, what have I come to? I've come to another world.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas now,
that still happens now for me all the time. Like, you just have to go to the right nights. Yeah, and it's still the same delight. And it's still sort of, you know, as obscure. Because, there'll be some things on YouTube, but not enough. Not really. And like someone like Ben Tarjay or...
Oh, I'm not saying it's gone in any way.
I think
there's to say that, you know, youth culture... Obviously, youth culture only really started in the 1940s. So there's a couple of generations where it was all an entirely new thing. By the time old men like us in the 80s, already, you know, it was becoming slightly kind of faded. They were beginning to use pop music in adverts. You know, that's a bizarre thing that in our lifetime, it never used... They would use a bit of classical music and that would be fine. And then someone went, imagine using a soul song to sell jeans. Yeah. This is, we've never imagined such a thing. Yeah. So I don't think that there's certainly not a lack now of exciting interest. In fact, a lot of the alternative stuff, I reckon if I went to see that now, as we did, do you remember when once we had to review Saturday Live? And we watched it and we went, well, this was, you know, as a 16-year-old, turning that on Channel 4 at 8:30, whatever it was on Saturday, going, look at this amazing world of an audience forced to stand up and watch comics who was saying the most amazing. And then you watch it now and you go, whoa, a lot of it was quite a bit like old punk and things like that. You go, it needed to happen, but it's not a thing best left in your mind and not returned to.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what was your first experience of a live gig?
I think We went to a lot of, like, God, this is going to sound really middle class. We went to a lot of, like, theatre shows.
You don't have to get quieter when you get middle class.
Well, you know, that's how it works. I went to see Lee Evans with my mum and my stepdad when I was 14. And I heckled by mistakes I didn't understand. So this is like about 6 months before I did my first gig, actually. I went to see Lee Evans and I went to see Eddie Izzard within about 2 weeks. And it is a bit ridiculous that but when I was doing stand-up, I hadn't done any seen much stand-up. But I think, to be honest, it was probably...
Well, you were very precocious. When we were going to gigs as teenagers, you instead were doing gigs as a teenager. You know,
it was definitely...
You know what? I think I was lucky that I hadn't seen very much. Right, basically, when I first started doing stand-up, I'd seen... Phil Jupiter's do Porky the Poet twice. Mm. Ted Chippington once. Sadovitz, Arnold Brown, Norman Lovett, and Arthur Smith.
Don't need to see anyone else.
Huh?
Don't need to see anyone
I know,
else.
And you know what? The thing is, if I'd seen loads of normal people talk about normal things, I think I'd have thought, I can't do that. But I was lucky that most of the first 10 people I saw were still people that I think are really great because they're really off-beam and, you know. And so I kind of thought that was what you were allowed to do, whereas I reckon if I'd seen more of it, I'd have lost my nerve. By the time I started, it was too late. I'd already thought that was how you did it.
Yeah, that's how I felt, like, in terms of, like, because I started before I realised that I could be frightened out of it or intimidated out of it and then just kept going. But I saw Lee Evans and he was doing a bit, and because I'd seen so much TV comedy, that's what really sort of switched me on, was sort of watching Monty Python and watching... I used to sneak upstairs and watch the Mary Whitehouse Experience and I didn't understand it at all. And I was like 8 or 9 and I used to like convulse with laughter. It like hurt me how much I was laughing at it. And I don't really understand. I just think it was just so exciting.
That's a sad thing to lose. You know, when you said that for like the most recently, I think the time that I've been two times I've been most recently been in agonising laughter was Steve Merchant about a year ago trying out an idea trying to buy a sheet of glass, which was just everything about him, I think, is, you know, 6'7", huge googly eyes, the constant fury that life hasn't worked out how he'd hoped. Yeah. That's, and that had me properly feeling a bit sick and I wanted him to stop. And the other one, I think, was Brian Gittins, this bizarre cafe owner, making an audience do the Hokey Cokey at the Green Man Festival at 2 a.m, which was a proper, I can no longer actually work out how to sit in a fold-up chair. And that's, but those things have...
I'm more often moved to tears now than laughter. As in my teens and 20s, I'd be moved to hysterics of laughter and I'm just weeping all the time.
Well, because you think it's beautiful all your time.
Yeah, I think things are beautiful. That seems to beget me more than...
I cried in Pappy's show this year.
Yeah.
It was very good. I love, I think Brian Gittins is so brilliantly funny because he can do things like just go and that's enough to like.
Well, that's the interesting thing is Brian Gittins is, I would say, that kind of thing. I don't know if there was a period of time or not. There's definitely been a period of time, by the way. That was a very broad statement. There have been a selection of period of times, whatever some physicists say. But the point in the 90s where things seemed to become so embraced by the media and the beginning of this kind of century, the 21st century. And then I don't know where the alternative starts again. If you see what I mean, because I think people still, some people just think all comedy is just comedy again. You know, in 1970, when we were growing up and we were, you know,
we
getting kind of fanzines and stuff,
and
there was the Young Ones. There was this thing which was very, very, you know, oh, wow, have you seen the Young Ones? The excitement and the bizarreness. And again, not getting a lot of the jokes as a 13-year-old, some of the things.
I tell you what, right, when in 1998, 1999, when I started gigging, I remember sort of doing a lot of gigs in like pubs and restaurants, etc., and them all being with like guys in suits talking about stuff, right? Then when I went to university, we did a lot of like mucking around, and then I came out of university in 2003 and started again, and that for me felt completely different scene wise.
You know,
in
what?
Those 4
I agree
years.
With you, because I stopped in about 1999, 2000, and then when I started again in about 2003, 2004. And actually saw people like you, or the venues, the clubs that Robin was running. I think something happened in that period, where I think what had been alternative comedy reached a sort of saturation point where there were lots of people going out for stag nights and hen nights to their big local club. And what seemed to have happened in the period I had off, or the period you were in further education, was that every town that had got a Jongleurs and a Comedy Store, suddenly it also had the other gig that was doing well, like the Comedy Box in Bristol or whatever. There always seemed to be like another one. And they did, and also lots of people like yourself and Robin and whatever seem to have set up these other kinds of gigs. And I mean, that's there really is an alternative circuit now. And it basically, if you're on that alternative circuit, you probably go to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And your dream is to try and get a tour of 100 to 200 seater arts centres. If you're not on that circuit, you do Comedy Stores, Jongleurs, whatever is Highlights, whatever they are now, and you go to Edinburgh once or twice, and your dream is to get spotted, to get on the roadshow, and then get a tour of 1,000 seater stadiums, theatres and stadiums. There is a slightly different thing, and that's short term as well. That's like, can you do that once or twice and then become some kind of celebrity?
Yeah.
And not have to really do stand up, and I think that alternative circuit, for want of a better word, and I think it'd be good if someone could come up with a name for it, is that it seems to be about people that are interested in the long term sustainability of operating at a reasonable level without massive overheads, you know, of actually doing stand up. The other one seems to be a shortcut, and that's why I think something like those roadshow type shows, it favours people that have got stuff that can be chopped up into 30-second chunks that works in isolation without a character or a setup or a point of view framing it. So you get a lot of people like that going through it. Some of them are very good, obviously. But
so you mean it's the observational that for a lot of that stuff to be successful is I'm just like you. Here are things that you do, and then of course you also have the Milton Joneses and the Tim Vines,
good,
and
really
like
good
as well.
Onliners,
but there's a schism, or the because about last year I just mentioned that I thought the Edinburgh Fringe Festival showed that there was now a mainstream and alternative circuit, and that there were two, and mainly the mainstream acts, friends of mine, were like going, oh, what are you saying? Well, I've got to kind of join in Michael McIntyre's army, and I went, well, it's not an attack. This is what I find interesting, is that I think there's nothing wrong with, you know, all of the kind of people like Michael McIntyre, etc., who you go, yes, the people want to watch it. It doesn't destroy comedy by them existing.
Well,
by having something
helps.
You know. Do you think it does? Because that's what I find interesting. Sometimes you seem quite pugilistic towards that.
Well, that's partly something I've realised that I've been doing, which is complicated, not something I'd ever find myself talking about. But I think that, you know, personally, I admire and like most stand-ups, right? Because even someone that's doing the same 20 for 10 years on the Highlights, Jongleurs, Comedy Store circuit still has to make real choices on a night in a room. You relate to them some way. Yeah. So personally, I always find it interesting to watch stand-up. The sort of Stuart Lee on stage is me, like, without... He sort of had the brakes removed a bit, and he'd be more angry about it, and, you know, and jealous and that sort of thing. So it's like, I do think it's a useful distinction to make, because I do think that there did seem to be a sort of assumption that if people aren't ready out of the box to do those kind of programs, those packaged kind of roadshow type shows, they must not be a good stand-up. Was actually, I think, on some way there must be something slightly deficient if you can do those programs, because it probably means you're not thinking about a bigger picture of a show as it works as now. It's probably nothing unique enough about your voice that means it can't be snipped up, you know. So I just think, but on the other hand, there's crowd control skills and joke writing skills that those comics have that are very different to something, say, Brian Gittins or Kevin McAleer could do, you know.
But then again, someone like Dave Allen would have, if you went back to his early days, would have fitted on something like the Roadshow perfectly, because he had great observational routines, you know, 5 to 10 minute routines where you could go.
I don't know if he would have done, to be honest.
Well, I think
the level of concentration required wouldn't.
Do you know, my trouble is I don't really watch them because I don't really watch any telly, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. In terms of the aims of what you're told, that may well be one of the problems, which is that you have to look out a little bit of going, maybe the aim doesn't have to be 10 minutes and then...
Think,
you know,
long term.
Yeah, and that's one of the harder things.
But also, I think, like, it's okay not to think about what you write like a shark. Do you know what I mean? You don't have to be like, oh, I need to be blah, blah, blah. You can just go, what are the things that sound delightful to me and how can I pursue those?
Yeah.
Or, you know, how can I write as much as possible and how can I enjoy it as much as possible and how can I make things my own? Like, it doesn't have to be so aggressive.
Yeah, well, I think, and until such a point as you've got responsibilities, either social or family or relationship or financial, you know, people should be trying to do what they want, to find their own voice. I mean, it is difficult, and it's much more difficult now than it was 20 years ago, because 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there were all sorts of back doors. It was cheaper to live. there was all sorts of benefits and scams, and you know, you got paid in cash for gigs. Transport was about a third of what it is now.
But also, so it was newer. Like people, yeah. I mean, people probably had done all those things, yeah. but in not so prominently. I think there was sort of less things to draw on in the tradition. Do you know what I was thinking though? 10 years ago, 9 years ago, I was thinking about me and my friend Andrew O'Neill. And he ran a club called the Troy Club.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I remember that.
And that was in the Troy Club in Kingley Street, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of above a semi-legal Spanish dance hall, yeah. which I think is still there.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so let's just call it a legal Spanish dance hall for the time being then.
Sure,
if it's still
sure.
there. Let's not close down the semi-legal Spanish dance hall due to your loose lips.
Okay, sorry. I think it's above just an empty shop.
Yeah, an empty shop or a legal Spanish dance hall, yeah.
And basically, it was a tiny little room. And, like, Russell Brand used to do it a lot and was incredible. Like,
he was good, wasn't he?
He was incredible.
He was terrible in the 90s.
Was he?
Started out,
I'd be that heroin.
Yeah. Then he was quite good for a bit. And then he became a celebrity.
Yeah, now I just wouldn't even know whether or not I could be bothered to watch it. But seeing him live, oh, my God, it was just incredible. Like, tiny little room. Anyway, what we had at that time was, like, this real visceral hatred towards what we thought was hack and what we thought was mainstream. And actually, I mean, to be honest, I don't know how much those clubs and my club at the time really, in a massive, meaningful sense, differentiated from other ones, you know. But I'm, like, writing tracts and pamphlets about, like, how much we hated the mainstream.
But I think you should start. You should start from that position, right? You know, you should start from that position and work backwards, right? You should, you know, when you can afford to occupy that sort of position, you should. And if you don't start from that position, what are you? You know, you should then, because actually life will crush all those beliefs out of you and all that idealism out of you, and reality will crush it out of you. And
he's not right. He's not right. I'm 30. I'm totally fine. But, he's not right.
This is the character Stuart Lee talking, not Stuart Lee the man.
You need to start from that position. I mean, I've been watching Seinfeld this week for the first time ever. I've never watched it before.
Wow, really?
I've never seen him do stand-up. Well, I was working all the time when it was
on
TV.
You saw that documentary, yeah?
I've seen that documentary. Yeah. I saw that 50-minute one. But I've never seen it. And obviously, in the sitcoms, I'm up to season 4 now.
It's really good,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it is really good. And you get kind of 30-second snippets of the stand-up. Two of the bits I thought were absolutely appalling, like just pathetic. Yeah. But mostly, I thought, that's quite interesting. He's like... he's done something there about a really dull subject and made it quite funny. And it made me think, maybe when I do series 3 of Comedy View, I'll try and do a week of like things that I would normally never want to write about, like lifts or elevators or restaurants, or see what you can do with it. Because actually, you know, that's having never done that.
Right. You know, I think. Was Seinfeld a thing for you guys when you were like hip, cool, young dudes?
No, see, that never happened. That we were young, but all other adjectives and words can be removed then.
Well, no, we didn't. I didn't. Never watched it.
But was that a choice? Was that like a...
Because it was on at midnight
and we were out,
on Tuesdays.
We were out doing gigs.
Yeah. And so I would normally get back in time
and
for
there wasn't
Larry
catch up.
Sanders.
There wasn't catch-up. Or DVD or YouTube.
What? How did you live in this horrible
primitive world? If you didn't see it when it was on, you wouldn't see
it. I also was alive at that time and understand that.
No, it was incredible,
that.
But not in Stuart's house. Stuart's house had none of the... Stuart lived in one of those kind of communities
Stuart, when I was young, we didn't have mobile phones.
In 1992, there wasn't catch-up and YouTube. So if you missed...
Stuart's Watland Dorp house in Balham there... I remember Pete Bainham putting the moss on the ceiling and it was all leaky.
He only half did his, like, his trying to do your voice.
No, do you know what? The other day I was doing another DVD for Go Faster, and I spent an evening just filming extras, basically, just titting around with an audience. And I wanted to do some jokes, just because I love jokes. And I realised that one of them was a Tom O'Connor joke. But the first time it was actually a Tom O'Connor joke. So I decided to do it. As you doing Tom O'Connor's joke. It takes ages.
Yeah,
oh man, Tom O'Connor did it in about 3 minutes. Doing your voice, going, oh no, it's, you know, turns out, you know, the Pope's his chauffeur, right? It was like, and I could see the audience going, because I was, you know, I've always complained about the fact I talk very quickly, which the advantage means that I don't have to do very crafted material. Hopefully, the rhythm eventually people just catch up. But the disadvantage is I have to use so many words, whereas you find a good sentence and repeat.
Well, you have to think very carefully about this.
If you're going to have one
actually,
sentence.
That one thing you said about DVD, there's another thing, right, is now, okay, there's people I meet have got opinions about American stand-ups that have never even toured this country or been on television, you know, and And likewise, I get emails from like America and stuff. It's really weird. Like you kind of there's and
but it's also lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but it does make this whole thing about I mean, basically, when we started on the show, there's about 200 people nationally doing what you'd call alternative comedy, and you could kind of write a joke, and you'd find out if someone had done something similar just by word of mouth. Whereas now, you're in a kind of global marketplace, aren't you? And you go, oh shit, you know. So that was that guy in Italy, wasn't it? He was ripping everyone off, and he got found out in the end.
Wait, was he on X Factor? Is that the guy?
No, there's an Italian comic, right? Who was doing a hodgepodge of sort of his set was like bits of my stuff, bits of. Tim Vine, bits of there was all kind of
that's old really
Bill Hicks. I know.
In Italy, Tom O'Connor joke is seen as one of the great absurdest moments.
That would be so funny if this guy, like, so when he's doing your bit, he slows right down, and then when he does Tim Vine, he puts on a hat and he's like,
I don't know how he did it. Now, perhaps the defining factor was that it was in Italian.
But that's the exciting thing is because that has changed. Because, you know, say a decade or more ago, there were certain acts that you would watch and you'd go, hang on, that's been taken from an American, you know, the because you'd hear people go, what do you think we'd call, what's that shop called, the big shop over there, Walmart? What do you think we call Walmart over here? And you go, why are you writing a joke based around Walmart? And then, of course, once all these shows came out, people went, oh, no, this is a disaster. Everyone's heard of these things. Yeah. But going back to the alternative thing is, because I don't know if that if there is a definition. If, in fact, this might be one of the problems now, is it's broad enough that you can't actually go, here is broad. Because what Michael McIntyre does... is probably does he actually go out there and go, I must create this for a market, or is it because he really wants to talk about?
No, I think he's wants to talk about.
So what I'm saying is, maybe what drives him is not. Sorry,
does he even write what he does?
Yeah, no, he does. All of it. Doesn't he? Oh well, I mean, I haven't really watched much.
Well, he doesn't
of his
write
stuff,
all of it because if you've been around long enough, you can spot the bits that he's bought off Paul Tonkinson.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah, like the routine about the 80s pop group The.
Oh right.
Which was a Paul Tonkinson routine.
I've forgotten that one.
It wouldn't occur. It's an old Paul Tonkinson routine from like 1989.
Oh, I
when
do remember that.
We're in the charts.
But overall, what he's writing that's what he. Because he does one thing that I know he gets a lot of flack. And, you know, he gets a lot of flack and he gets a lot of money. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Once you're that famous, that's what happens. Right. But I would say he obviously really does love comedy. There are some people you meet and you think this is just a stepping stone or you're just doing it because the hours, you know, you don't really care. But he is very passionate about what he does and very worried about.
I think he really, you know, likes seeing that. So can I go back to this? When you talk about what's alternative and what's not, and you're talking about this happened in 1980, this happened in 1990, one of the things that's different now, I think, I noticed this... hanging on to my little music critic job, is that there used to be a sort of linear cultural progression, right, in influences, right, and things would come and go and whatever. And like, for example, in pop music, you could sort of see, like, when people got in, lots of people got into big star, mainly Glaswegian bands, in about 1990. Someone told me that's because Fop found a load of old big star records and sold them in Scottish record shops, and then suddenly all Scottish indie bands sounded a bit like big star.
That is where I got my first big star record,
well,
in the old
honest,
Fops.
22 or 3 years ago, it's not an impossible thing to think, because again, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't, so you know, things did go in sort of ways. Like, there's a theory that all indie bands from New Zealand in the 1980s sounded like the Velvet Underground because somebody had a Velvet Underground album in Dunedin, you know, and it's sort of that simple. So there used to be like linear cultural progressions of things, and obviously alternative comedy in the 80s was a reaction to the 70s, and then you had the new lad stuff in the 90s that was a reaction to the politically correct stuff of the 80s, and on and on and on. Right, the weird thing now, I listened to a record the other day by a group called Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel, right?
They'll never get anywhere with that name.
I know, well, it sounds like Budgie, who are an incredibly unfashionable early 70s British blues rock band, but it sounds like Budgie with 60s sort of psychedelic effects on it, played in a way that sounds a bit like a late 70s New York punk band. Now, that would never... I don't think that would ever have happened 20 years ago, but now it happens because all things are available for you to listen to simultaneously, whereas before you had to kind of... There were things
the thing
that came and went. So
iTunes,
with comedy, you're not, you know, they can take what they want from different times, can't they?
Yeah, that's like with iTunes, the way that some songs now are in the charts, but they're from 1983 because they will have been used in a film or something and they pick up on it.
What I find most interesting about the Glasgow Big Star thing is I bought my first Big Star album in the Glasgow Fop. In the early 90s, but I also bought the Best of the Bangles. So looking at the kind of many worlds interpretation, there are now many bands, early 90s Glasgow bands, that actually were more influenced by Bangles than Big Star.
Except what's the best Bangles record?
Walk Like an Egyptian.
Cover of September Girls by Big Star.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, which is on that album with all the squares on the front, which they were covering Big Star when you couldn't get a Big Star record anywhere. So, you know, it may
I haven't got that. I've got Hazy Shade of, you know.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, very nice.
But, you know, I mean, it's sort of... So I should imagine with comedy, if you're someone in your teens that's into comedy, you can look on YouTube and you can look at all different stuff from all different eras, and it isn't sort of codified like it used to be when we were younger, where it went in chronological periods. Mm. It's just all this stuff you can sort of have a look at.
But I would say that comedy dates in a way that music doesn't. Like, I think that, not totally, but I think that some stuff that's older will forever be just that kind of step away in relatability that you can't ever completely bridge in a way that I don't think music is. I think music things come in and out of fashion or things sound wrong or right at different times. But I think with some older comedy, it's just too far away.
But is it revolutionary? This is the thing that I don't know if we've ever managed to get to the bottom of, that comedy that's seen as revolutionary often dates quite badly. Like Young Ones, for, I know I have met some teenagers who do like the Young Ones, but overall they find it a bit weird. Monty Python, a lot of people find very difficult to watch.
Well, I loved the Goons, it.
But no, I'm just going through the general thing that those things.
The Goodies, many people, is hard going.
The Goodies can be
and
very
yet,
hard
that
going.
That seemed but, amazing to us.
You know, Keaton, Laurel and Hardy, and all those kind of things. Have so what is, you know, that those things were not necessarily revolutionary what they were doing, but what they were doing was creating masterpieces within that world. Yeah. So is that the difference between kind of,
you know, to be honest, it's hard for us to say about things like Chapman and Keaton and Laurel and Hardy, because like when we look at top comics today, because we have been in the circuit for 10, 20, 25 years or watching it for 30 years even, you sort of know who their influences are. You know whose bits they've cherry-picked. Like when Russell Brand did his first comedy lab for Channel 4, it was just exactly Noel Fielding. Mm. And I thought, my God, he's going to become famous for doing that guy's act. It's so weird. Because he'd had a sort of heroin addict thing where he kind of magpied stuff off people, you know. But what's weird about Laurel and Hardy and Chapman is, if you read the books, you know, they'll tell you that Stan Laurel went to the States and took, like, bits of George Robey and loads of London music hall acts or clowns, and that Chapman as well was very dependent on things that he'd taken from here. So, you know, in a way, what you're seeing with them is a kind of... a patchwork of lots of stuff that was around, so it's harder for us to say. But I do think, weirdly, that they seem to have a timelessness about them that... things from the 80s, for example.
But also Sergeant Bilko. Sergeant Bilko's, I mean, a thing I think is interesting about you, Stuart, though, as well, is that you, a lesson that we should learn from you is that I just thought you were doing jazz hands. Sorry, I just thought you'd suddenly...
You've ruined how discreet it was.
No, but the that you stole your kind of style and act from someone that most people hadn't heard of. So people see you as an original. Yeah. So is the real lesson of your life steal from those that are, you know, not really known?
Yeah, well, you know, you're right. I mean, when I listen to tapes of me from 89, 90, which I do every day, no, I don't. I've very much got the cadences of Ted Chippington. But he didn't talk about anything. You know, that's the weird thing. Like, but I noticed this happening with me. I mean, like, Tony Law keeps getting compared to me now. And I sort of think, well, I can see why that is, because he sort of got a lot of the playfulness of... he was sort of doing it anyway, but he sort of cemented it, like, taking things apart. But he doesn't talk about issues or ideas. So it's a different kind of thing, you know.
Well, that's like, when everyone says original voices, there are... I don't know if such a thing as a truly original voice, in the same way as, you know, when someone goes, someone's written a story that no one's written before. That's never really going to happen. That it then becomes the way that you... Sorry, Joseph.
But it's... No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's also kind of pointless and unhelpful to try and look for people that are divorced from the culture around them. That's not...
Yeah, but they've got to write something during Edinburgh Fringe Festival, haven't they? Some of the load of rot.
Just write that the person looks like a special needs child. That's what they write about me.
So. Is that what you got? Who wrote that about you?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just saying.
You made that sound like that was the other you, like Raising Cain, the John Lithgow, Brian De Palma film. There are two Josie Longs, and one of them goes on and self-loathes on the internet, and then the other doesn't realise it's actually her own hand that has written these things.
John Lithgow is so versatile. What a versatile actor.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say about that.
That's the end of our special John Lithgow episode.
Do you know what else I've seen recently that I really enjoyed? Sorry, this is not that relevant. The film Young Adult. Have you seen that?
No.
It's really good. It's Charlize
Theron. Is it as good as The Baby?
Oh, I remember that.
What's
yeah,
the baby?
Ted Post. The baby. Someone asked me about it the other day.
It's a sort of 60s, 70s film about a man who's raised as a baby by his mother until he's very old.
Yeah, he's like 30-something baby. And a woman comes in and starts looking after him and goes, oh, my goodness, what are they doing? And then there's an amazing... It's really an episode of The Twilight Zone, isn't it? Or Night Gallery. But it's 90 minutes long.
Spoil the film.
And it is one of those... Because someone was saying, I was reading about Heaven's Gate the other day, and they said that was, thinking again about the alternative and the mainstream, where I find it interesting now that I think it's not harder because of DVD, but in terms of in the cinema, to see alternative films. There's not that many alternative films that you can go and see. There used to be kind of like, you know, 7 a week where you go...
They don't get the showings,
And so you have to dig them out. And someone said, well, Heaven's Gate was one of the causes of that, was because here was an auteur film that was such a disaster. Yeah. They went, just make big, exciting special effects movies, the Jaws thing.
And please give us more pressy about Heaven's Gate.
Well, Heaven's Gate was, it was Michael Cimino. He'd just made Deer Hunter. Deer Hunter had been hugely successful.
So they were like, you'll have all the money you want. Make
United
your dream
Artists,
film.
Which actually was started by Chaplin, I think, possibly Lillian Gish. Yeah. This was the, and they used to do the Bond films, I think, as well. They put all their money into this huge, vast, basically kind of like a cowboy film about early or 19th century settlers in the US. And it just absolutely tanked.
Was it bad?
It was a disaster.
Was it
absolute
a bad film?
Disaster. I don't know, really. It was a long time ago when I saw it, and it seemed long.
Right.
And now, it's kind of entered that period of time where people go, it was so underrated, it's actually a masterpiece. Mm. And now, I think, and in another 10 years, people go, actually, it was all right. It was all right. Yeah, that's what it was. So we haven't really got anywhere, I suppose, with the... Well, it doesn't matter, though, does it? It's always interesting. Whenever we talk about comedy on the show, it always becomes the most serious subject, doesn't it?
Yeah. But, I mean, I think that the fact that... There is a kind of homogenousness about the sorts of people that you see on the big stand-up shows on telly. I do think that helps to create an alternative culture and market. Certainly, if I was a teenager now and I was watching all those shows, I would hate them.
Mm.
And I would hate all the people on them, and I wouldn't want to be a stand-up. But then if I came and saw some of the sorts of nights you put on, I might want to be. You know, so it's sort of the other thing is it also benefits them, because the fact that there's an alternative. I mean, I noticed the reviews for Kevin Bridges and Michael McIntyre and whatever this time around on their tours in the broadsheets, they tend to go, well, it doesn't do this and it doesn't do this and it doesn't do this and it doesn't do this, but 12,000 people were laughing and you'd be churlish not to admit that 3 stars. So I think actually the existence of an alternative, of an unreliable alternative scene where things might be shit but will be interesting, actually helps consolidate those things as well, because it means if you want a dependable big night out, you go to see those people. So I think it's quite helpful. What was sort of unhelpful, I think, was when people with very different aims are being judged against each other by critics and the public. You know, they're not trying to do the same thing, and there is a kind of assumption that all comedy is the same, whereas no one would say that about music. You know, no one would go to see a quiet piece of Estonian holy minimalist classical music and say it wasn't loud enough.
Yeah,
I couldn't dance to it. You just knew that its purpose was different.
I try to explain that when I get people, you know, when you get a message every now and again, I understand why you avoid the internet, and someone just says, you're not funny.
Yeah.
And I will always, you know, just reply going, you don't understand the difference between subjective and objective, but thank you for your feedback. Because that's but people get so passionate more than anything else. Whenever I write anything about comedy, I get more reactions saying either that I'm right or I'm wrong, or I'm glad someone's written this, or I'm furious someone's written this, than if you write about something which seems to actually have world importance. You know, when people get, like, on forums and stuff like that, sometimes there's tremendous aggression about someone who you go, well, they're not even on telly very much. When people get furious about something that is easily avoidable, you can be furious about a politician because you think they are in some ways affecting my world, possibly, by what they're doing. But going, do you know what makes me really angry? Sometimes I walk past that comedy club in Rathbone Place and the window's open and I hear a sentence come out from that comic and that makes me furious. And you go, just walk quicker. It's fine. Maybe they'll close the window next time. It's winter now. It's all right.
Well, the only thing that seems comparable to me is when I stumble through talk radio and loads of people seem to have an opinion about how they would manage the England football team. even though they have no background.
And
in
they're
sport,
so angry. About
so angry about how they would do it differently, even though you know they're probably 30 stone and never even run for a ball or, you know. But I think with comedy, it's that everyone likes to think they have a sense of humour. And it's one of the things on dating things, isn't it? GSOH. Yeah. Good sense of humour. We all like to think we have a sense of humour and it defines us in some way and that it's a good thing to have. So I suppose that's why people get wound up about comedy. Because if you don't get a joke, on some level you feel you're being judged.
Well, that's the difference, because I think one of the things you've said, just going back to that, is unreliability is something which I think we need to promote more often.
Yeah.
I think with one of the wonderful things about the, and it happens, there's lots of clubs now that are doing this more and more, which is going, you've come here, we're all going to experiment, hopefully you're going to enjoy it. Mm. I think what happens sometimes is that the audience go, and I've noticed this in festivals now, I know you don't really do music festivals now, but I remember years ago when we were talking at Glastonbury, and you went, the wonderful thing about Glastonbury is you go out there and you play to an audience of people, you go, I'd like to drink with any of these people, they're into music. And now I've noticed, because festivals are really mainstream as well.
Yeah.
You have people walking past going, I mean, I was really angry because I walked past a tent, I'm with my 7-year-old, and I heard someone say fuck. And you go, you're in a festival. Yeah, it's like, you know, when I was with Archie and we were at the Green Man this year, we finally find somewhere where we can get a corn burger. We sit there and Sexy Motherfucker comes on the sound system. Yeah, yeah. And as I said that night, you know, the only time, you have never realised how many times the phrase Sexy Motherfucker is in the song Sexy Motherfucker till you're sat with a 4.5-year-old.
Yeah.
But I don't go, I'm furious. I go, I've come into a field that's a festival.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I think the audience now sometimes, that they go, entertain me, hurry up, keep entertaining me.
Well,
and you go,
yeah.
Well, there's a two-way thing here.
Yeah. I think if people think, you know, that everything's for them, and I think it's because there's so much choice now, it's like you kind of expect to be entertained on your own terms. In Edinburgh, I did that show. There was a show in Edinburgh this year called The Return of the Lumberjacks, and it was Stuart Francis, and
Glenn Wool,
and Craig Campbell, who were all Canadian and 15 years ago had done a show together, which is probably a really good pairing then. Now, in a way, it isn't, because Stu Francis is massive. I mean, he's on all those package shows on telly and thousands of people go and see him. And I did it as a guest at the weekend. And there was a sizable minority of the audience that were waiting for Stu Francis. And after Glenn had been on and Craig had been on and me, they were still shouting that they hadn't seen any comedy yet.
Really?
You know, yeah. And
there were people heckling that.
Yeah, people heckling that. And it's and I think that's because they come in with an
so funny.
I know, yeah.
The rest of you, awful.
I know, yeah. Well, they were all. I know. They certainly had seen. Not only had they seen comedy, they'd sort of seen all comedy, really.
kind of spread of different kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I know. So
comedy,
it was weird, and I think that's because they have an expectation of getting what they've seen, right? You know, so in a way, the problem with those programs is they close people's minds down a bit,
exactly.
Unless they were to broaden their horizons, which they sort of can't, because you can see on them when they take a bit of a punt on someone, sometimes they find it quite hard to find supportive reaction shots from the audience. When there's the kind of act on Live at the Apollo that we would all stand at the back really laughing at, you can see the audience struggling with it.
Basically, that's the thing, which is, there's definitely this thing now that there wasn't 10 years ago about, like, they've been on the telly, they've not been on the telly, which is more like America, I suppose, or something like that. That people kind of... that little bit more celebrity about it, and that little bit more like stratifying things in a way that I don't think they were as much 10 years ago. I don't know what that really means about comedy.
Well, club owners say that on the internet. Club owners say, you know, you can't get anyone in now unless you've got someone who's been on Roadshow on your bill. But, you know, they've always got reason.
Do you know what? You can also, or you create a club where you build a kind of the
you
reputation of the cultish thing.
Yeah, you create a club where you say, I guarantee you will not see anyone that has been on Roadshow on it. And then you get an audience like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of...
Yeah.
See, I think that's an interesting, because that thing of, cause, you know, I know what I do is quite niche, and it's kind of broad in terms of the age group, but I'm definitely niche. And I found that thing of expectation where I've done a few gigs at Hammersmith, like kind of sciencey gigs and Douglas Adams birthday gig, and every time it's a joy, 3,500 people, and I'm there dicking about quantum mechanics or whatever. And then I did a Scope benefit, which Ben Elton was hosting.
Yeah.
And now I'm
in the same room.
Yeah. And so you've got.
Oh, it's
and
such
I walked,
a shock,
and
isn't
as
it?
I walked on, I thought, oh, I'm going to change what I was going to do. I've realised that. I could tell by the reaction.
Yeah.
You know, there was even seemed to be some people, I think, had heard of me because there was a sense of annoyance in their applause.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, no, I think I better change something. I'll do that bit. Also, I should have done my flies up. Always do your flies up when you're having flies. But that thing, and I found when I did your show that you produced for you know, as you know, I had a bit of a weird time.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
And as I walked in, I thought, because, you know, you've produced a show, kind of the alternative comedy thing. Yeah. And it's affected me for about 2 months, by the way.
Well, you know what that was, right? Was basically, we got all people on that. We've made a series for Comedy Central that's called The Alternative Comedy Experience. And the idea was to have all the sorts of people that would fit that brief. And so we had to fill 10 audiences over 5 days at the Stand in Edinburgh, which is about 150-seater. And there were about two shows, the early evening ones, midweek, where we hadn't sort of filled it with the majority of people that would normally go to the Stand or people that we wanted. And you were in one of those. There were people that were kind of bussed in by the television audience company, and they didn't really... A lot of the people that were in those shows had more difficult times. Although, to be fair, you were all asked to contact your own mailing lists about the show. Which you didn't do, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Did you?
Oh, I don't have a mailing list.
Well, you know.
But also, I just played there as well. That was one of the other things. But no, but I'm not blaming that. What I think is interesting is that because sometimes you get so used to the audience that I play to on tour,
that.
And then I suddenly go, and so I have no idea why is this not working? I don't understand why this isn't working. Yeah. Because, you know, references to Schrodinger and those kind of things, or to Heisenberg, whatever it might be. And that can be a danger as well.
You need to put a sentence in before mentioning those things that explains what they are.
Yeah, and that's why I forget sometimes.
Snobbishly assuming.
Yeah, but you do that. That's another half hour onto the show.
Yeah, but to be fair, you know, Stuart's act is about snobbish assumptions. So that's what the whole thing. Well, sorry, the character Stuart Lee.
It's not actually. I never mention a thing that I think people won't know about.
Do you know what? I get this thing, and I don't want to be tetchy about this, and this isn't about your show, this is just generally, but I think Schrodinger's cat being the most famous thought experiment of all time. Do you know what? Catch the fuck up. Schrodinger's cat is no. I'm sick of that
idea.
But
what about people who are like 12, 13, 14 who don't know what that is?
They're not in there, are they? Because there's a licensing thing where...
What, they sneak in?
And actually, do you know what? I get 13, 14-year-olds in the audience.
I know, and sometimes they'll be like, oh, I love it, because they haven't drunk any alcohol yet. But the thing is, you've got to accept that there'll be some people who are ignorant not by choice, just by circumstance. For example, when I was a teenager, I didn't know about the existence of things like Bikini Kill, so I liked things like Hole. That is not to my detriment, that's just because I was groping for what I wanted and I couldn't find it.
Did you use the Babes in Toyland bridge that was made or not?
I did. The only way I found Babes in Toyland was by going to a proto Poundland and looking through the tapes and buying myself
that
a
was
Babes
Harmon Leon's sister, you know, Babes in Toyland.
Who's Harmon Leon?
Not Cat Biel.
No, Michelle Leon in Babes in Toyland.
Who's Harmon Leon?
Harmon Leon was an American stand-up who still does The Fringe occasionally, but I think he sort of must have independent wealth of some sort. He had.
He's got all that Toyland money, right?
No, he had some great bits. Harmon, we went and stayed with him in San Francisco in the early 90s and met lots of people that subsequently became famous, like the bloke that did that, you know, that magazine Might. It became another one.
Dave Eggers.
Yeah, Dave Eggers was around. I used to do stuff with him.
Harmon Leon, he's... thanks very much. The producer's coming. We've got to stop now. This podcast was produced by Adrian McKinder and edited by Mike Pell. Now...
Please, if you listen to this in the next 50-odd days, would you sponsor my film just for 50 pence or a pound at sponsume.com/romance_and_adventure.
For more podcasts, visit comedycentral.co.uk/podcast. Do you see what I did there? I actually put it in the middle of the thing. So they've got to keep
it.
And Stuart's DVD is out in November. His new Carpet Remnant World DVD is out in November.
Oh, I've got a
I'm on tour as well. You're on tour.
Yeah,
I'm not on tour. Go and see Josie Long on tour.